I get a kick out of the number of people who are clicking on to the picture of the sheep that was born with a human face on its creepy picture. I warn you again about that. But I'm just about to put up another blog, too. Just a quick follow-up in that it is the kickoff for the annual Girl Scout cookie season. I've got a quick note. I'll put on my blog on that in just a second. Also, if you go online at coasttocoastam.com, there's a link on my blog for a charity if you're looking for somebody that can help out in Haiti and you don't have one or you haven't been able to connect with somebody. Take a look on that. And it's a group I'm involved with, and money, almost every penny of it goes directly to the people in Haiti. It's a very well-run organization with already people on the ground ready to help. Also, click on to Joel Barker. Find out more about futurist Joel Barker and all of the projects that he's up to, the various books he's written. Great for business, but great for personal amusement, too, especially the five regions of the future. Like that book a lot. And we'll get back to it. We'll wrap up the predictions made by the New York Times Magazine of the year 2000 for what we would have with us in 2010. Several of them very compelling and are already here. And then we'll get to the list of what Joel predicts for 2020 next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Okay, so we were going through the list from the New York Times Magazine from the year 2000 of the things we would have in 2010. We're almost there. We're kind of down to the top five. And we come to something which we do have in the year 2010, and that's the dead celebrity who has come back to life. I thought this was an interesting prediction in the year 2000. I guess they hadn't really done this back then yet.
Just barely getting started in extremely crude. And now we look at it, how sophisticated it is, the fact that you can take an old actor, capture their movements, capture their facial reactions, and apply it in a sense. It's the digital reality concept that we'll be talking about in more detail.
Well, and I think the digital reality, again, was driven here by a commercial need. That, right? I mean, we saw this really market-driven, is that people still trusted dead celebrities over living ones.
Literally commercial.
Right. And they were much more willing to buy beer from John Wayne than they were from, say, you know, I'm trying to think of the, like, you know, Bruce Willis or some action star for today. And so, I mean, I think that's kind of cool that they came up with this and had a this innovation now is fairly common. We can see celebrities brought back to life in ways not only just for commercials but also in music videos. And it's you know, I'm kind of waiting for them to come up with a new Humphrey Bogart movie.
Yeah, I am too. A full length feature.
Yeah, of just using computer generated Humphrey Bogart.
Yep.
That may already be on somebody's drawing board somewhere. The blind date. Who is your destiny? Do we put this under the hit or miss category from 2000?
It's called eHarmony.
Yeah, talk about that.
Well, we have multiple online dating systems that try to do actual useful analysis and match you up with people. And so it's not perfect yet, but it certainly fits the parameters you're suggesting here. So I'd say of all the things that they had here, I thought this was actually closest in terms of really, you know, spelling it out and saying, this is the way it will be. You'll fill out this form and, you know, everything will come back and you'll match up with people. So we are doing that.
I thought there were a couple of these other online dating systems, too, that had even perfected it even more than eHarmony, that they'd come up with these new systems, psychological profiles, and they were getting better matches than the more generalized eHarmony. Have you heard about that?
I have to tell you, I have not followed this piece of technology very closely because I have a wife of 35 years.
And right.
No need for more harmony.
I understand that. But I was talking to a psychologist who was working with one group, and they were claiming, you know, a fairly staggering statistic for. They had a smaller database. They weren't bringing in as many people as eHarmony, but they had a better success rate, they said.
And it is, right. A good pun is a database.
Yes, a database. The company where everybody's a temp. Well, don't we have that now?
Yeah, boy, do we ever. And, you know, this actually, the discussion started about 1996, 1997. Business Week talked about the new company that was, in fact, a virtual company, and they talked about Hollywood and how they made a movie, bringing everybody together, doing the project, and everybody disappearing, and that that was the model for the future, and we are seeing that more and more, though there is still something very important to be said about ongoing integrity of the organization, because that's where the culture is embedded. It exists in an ongoing way, not in an episodic way.
Okay, love that. The elevator, but you know what? I'm going to go back. I love that in the sense that they hit that, and that there was a prediction about that, and that under the right circumstances, the company where everybody's a temp can be a good thing.
Absolutely.
But there is a level of that that still strikes me as a kind of exploitation right now.
Yeah.
And where a lot of people are doing the work that they used to get full-time pay for,
yeah,
because they've just been relegated to a temp, and that there's a legal, you know, category that they slide into. And I think that that's a weird culture clash for me, where there's full-time workers who get paid what they should be paid for, I think, a fair compensation for, yeah, and then other people that are kind of shoehorned in that are not getting paid what they're worth, just under the threat of, if you don't like it, don't show up here tomorrow.
Yeah. The Andy Hines, who's a friend of mine, who is also a co-chair of the Association of Professional Futurists, sent me a note when I told him I was going to be on the show, and he talked about the 21st century guilds that people would join to protect themselves from being abused.
Well, I think this is really good. Talk about that, because the guild is sort of some people might just associate that with a labor union, but it's a little more nuanced than a labor union.
The whole concept behind it is that we make sure you're well-trained. Well, actually, the unions grew out of it, so there is a lot of connection, but you're well-trained, you have integrity, you know, we vouch for you. When somebody's looking for a job, we spread the work around so everybody has it, and that you cannot be abused in the job, because they won't be able to come to the guild to get anybody again. They'll just close you off. Nope, you don't get any accountants anymore. Sorry.
Right.
And so the power is actually greater than a labor union in that sense, in that they can kind of close off access. Even though you need one or two, you have to have them. It's not like having 1,000 of them. So I think there's actually an argument that says that a whole bunch of knowledge workers will begin to form guilds to create that kind of protection for them, but also to create a chance to, in a sense, have a smoother employment over a longer term.
You know, some of the inspiration for guilds was that they protected trade secrets. They knew that knowledge was a marketable power, and so if you wanted to get somebody to do a particular job, you had to get him from the guild. They were the only ones that knew the secrets, and you would not be given the secrets. You would just be given the benefit of the labor of the people that knew the secrets. And I thought that's kind of an interesting way of looking at the future, is can people commoditize their skill set? And in such a way that, sure, they become a virtual employee. They come in, they go out, everybody's a temp. But they also retain valuable information that allows them to also participate in the free market system, that they're getting the most they can get,
yep,
for what they're able to do.
And so you could even make one further observation, Ian, which is, as they move from organization to organization, they are picking up information that no person in any one of those organizations would have, which makes their capacity,
yeah,
greater and wiser. So they actually have higher value by moving around than they do if they'd stay in one place.
It's a little bit like you.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of like that. As a consultant, as a motivational speaker, you pick up pollen from every flower on which you land,
there's
and
no
bring
question.
It to the next one.
That's right. And because I mix industries, in fact, I'm literally going to a client in February that is the other side of a Verge discussion that I had last fall. And I'm going to be putting two companies that would never think to come together. So that is an example of this, the exposure that I've had, where I can say, you two need to talk. If you put these two things together, you can have a really powerful innovation.
The days of going to work for a bank and staying there for 30 years are over. Even the most stable industries have unpredictable workforce futures. So we might as well get good with the idea. Everybody's in radio. That's how I say it. Everybody's in radio.
Yeah.
The elevator that you never have to wait for. This was a prediction back in the year 2000 by the New York Times Magazine.
Yeah, it was actually a cheaty prediction, because 1997, Otis Elevator announced the Odyssey Elevator, which is this elevator this person is describing. So they were actually working off a significant statement by Otis Elevator. But I Googled it just to see how it was doing, and I went to the Otis thing and Googled Odyssey Elevator and their search thing, and nothing came up. So I don't think they did it.
Interesting. So they cheated and they still failed. Cheaters never prosper.
It was a really tricky idea.
The French fry that will save your life. We need more of these smart foods, but they are coming.
Yep. How about at least the French fry that doesn't kill you?
Right.
You know, we've got that now.
Let's call it a draw.
Yep.
but this is these foodaceuticals or whatever they're calling it, where people can eat foods that are treated and or developed that will enhance your immune system.
Nutraceuticals.
Yep. And so that is coming. That is it. We'll put that under the hit category.
Yeah, I would.
The doctor that floats in your bloodstream.
No, it's really the doctor that swims in your intestinal tract.
Okay, talk about that.
We haven't got it small enough yet to float in the bloodstream, but we do have them small enough so you can swallow them, and it'll run through your intestinal tract with a TV camera and other monitors and send out significant data about what's going on in your intestinal tract. So we're halfway there.
So it's a little bit like the movie Fantastic Voyage.
Yeah.
Just
except
a little
going
bit.
Going through the alimentary canal instead.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it wouldn't be as much fun if the movie would be very limited. They're remaking Fantastic Voyage right now.
Oh, hopefully it'll be in the bloodstream.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. Of course, the classic sci-fi movie about these little miniaturized people and thing that was going through the bloodstream. But in this case, the information that does come back, it's coming back from places where you can't get a sensor otherwise, and doctors are pretty much guessing or going by secondary data that they can collect from your body. So this is a primary way of looking at the function, for example, of your colon,
yep,
looking for polyps or other things, or the beginning of other problems in your intestine.
Well, and the other thing you get is you get a linear track of the chemical changes, which also can be indicative of things.
So it's not in the bloodstream yet, but that one we could say reasonably is coming.
They're moving in the right direction.
And finally then, in the New York Times Magazine piece from the year 2000 about what we would have in the year 2010, the genius who sticks around forever.
Yeah.
This was, I'm going to see here what they wrote. They say that wisdom accumulates, that perhaps it is not subject to the same TikTok corrosion that renders bones frail and hair thin. They're calling it the soul catcher, this device, which would be able to save the accumulated knowledge of people.
Yep.
Roughly.
Basically, it's an implanted chip, and it's, in a sense, it's making a record of what you're thinking and what you're remembering, so that when you die, they take the chip out and then they've got all your thinking.
We don't have it yet. How far away are we from getting it?
Well, Ray Kurzweil, who wrote The Singularity Is Near, believes we'll have it before 2025. Others think it's way long because we don't know what we're capturing. That thought is, in fact, much more complex and clever than just putting a bunch of data points on a computer chip.
Right.
So it's a big debate. And, Kurzweil basically says when you get enough connections, you get the emergence of intelligence. And if he's right, then we'll have it before 2025.
Well, that would be interesting. And so that would be a separate category, things we'll have by the year 2025. Yep. I know that you, Joel Barker, had been working on your predictions that we would have for sure by the year 2010. And so, is there a particular order to these predictions as you see them?
Oh, there's kind of some clustering. And remember, it's 2020, not 2010 that we're going for here.
Did I say 2010? I'm sorry. For 2020. Yeah. Right. Well, here we are in 2010, and we're looking ahead at 2020.
And here, I want to condition this a little bit, too, because it's not so much for sure as there are very plausible innovations that I can give you reasons for why I think they're going to happen. But what we also have to remember is that we keep getting surprised, and that is the nature of innovation. It's the nature of the world changing. You know, you think about the number of anti-terrorist innovations that have been developed since 9/11. Had 9/11 not happened, we would have very few of those. So what I'm going to share with you is some plausible stuff, some things that my friends in the Association of Professional Futurists said, you might as well mention that too. And we'll just see where we go with it, okay?
What does one have to do to become a member of the Society of Professional Futurists?
Well, if you go to APF.com, you can actually download what the requirements are. But you have a professional futurist, somebody who actually makes a portion of their income thinking about the future.
Well, that would be me.
Yeah, it would, actually. You should
Wouldn't be I qualify?
To, you should qualify, absolutely.
I can't shut up about it. I don't know if that, I'm not sure what that means in terms of how much of my, what my income is from it, but I can't, so far I'm not on a way to turn me off. But I'm always thinking about it, and I find myself very future focused because I always think in terms of 5-year plans for me and for my family, and that's worked for me very well to be living in the now, but to use the future as a way for me to put a lens on what I'm doing now, not at the past,
yep.
Not to use the past to see whether or not I'm doing all right, but how am I doing in terms of where I'm going to land from this? Everything I do to a degree has a trajectory
yep.
into the future,
yep.
And that's what I'm more focused on.
And you and I think, both believe that having a powerful, positive vision of your future is a really useful thing, even if you don't get there. It's a benchmark against to say, I'm turning this direction for this reason. So I'm changing my vision. But I am absolutely convinced, especially in times like this, that those people who think out 3 to 5 years at least have a tremendous advantage over those who are saying, well, you know, it's so confusing out there. I'll just roll with the punches. You know?
So you'll sponsor me into the fraternity?
Absolutely.
Do I get like a decoder ring? Do I get anything cool? Do I get like a lapel pin?
You actually get invitations to really cool meetings.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, once a year we have a really good meeting. It's the best stuff I've participated in terms of, you know, people who are authentically doing the work and really think a lot about it. So,
well, you know, fun. I've been involved in a lot of conversations about the future of the church. And what I've learned from that is that there are many organizations that love to look ahead and see the things that they need to do in order to change and meet future demands.
Yep.
And then once they have that on a piece of paper, they fold it up, put it in an envelope, and burn it.
And they
never do anything that they say they're going to do.
Makes you cry.
It's odd, but I mean, there are lots of really interesting things. Oh, would that be cool if we did that? No, we don't want to do that. So,
well, half the work is coming up with the vision. The other half the work is coming up with the pathway.
Well, and coming up with the people who can see the vision.
Yep.
Right? And then cultivating the people that can actually implement a vision.
Absolutely.
You can have a great vision and not have the right people. It just sits there.
Yep.
All right, so let's leave that there for the time being, and then we'll come back to this then. Joel Barker's predictions for the year 2020. We'll get to as many of these as we can, and then we'll get to your calls, too, coming up. But very interesting. He's put a lot of time into this, done a lot of research, and the following are things that I would be willing to bet on. Unlike the New York Times Magazine piece back in the year 2000 for this year, I put cash money down on Joel Barker any day of the week. So let's find out what the future will have for us in 10 years. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Welcome to the future. There's nothing you can do to stop it. It's coming. We can all be, you know, deer in the headlights and simply get run over by it, or we can thumb a ride and see where it takes us. And that's just what we're going to do next with Joel Barker, futurist, and we'll get his predictions for the year 2020, then take your calls coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Enjoying this conversation so much, but I always do whenever Joel is on. And if you go to the website at coasttocoastam.com, you can link up to Joel there. Also, I've put up a new blog, different from the one I had earlier in the evening, which is still up. You just scroll down a little bit. But a short one about Girl Scout cookies. Have you seen the poster about Girl Scout cookies? Hey, you'll be sending this around to people that you know. Just click onto the blog. You'll love the link at coasttocoastam.com. And you'll love what the future will bring. By the year 2020, you will have, and we'll fill in that blank next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So where do we start, Joel Barker, looking ahead at the year 2020?
Well, we can start with some little stuff and then head, and then I'll do some kind of thoughtful aggregation as we move along to say, you think about all these things together and this is what we're seeing. Couple of things just for people. I want to read a quote from Stephen Aguilar Milan, who runs the Futures Observatory over in the UK. He says, "I alert clients to the possibilities rather than make predictions." And that's professional futurists. We don't like the word prediction because it sounds too certain. And what we know is that there are lots of other ideas that are going to interact with and lots of trends that are going to begin to grow that are not growing right now. And so we're more interested in saying, here are some interesting things that right now, given the trends right now, seem to have weight and speed and momentum, and therefore we should pay attention to them. A book that I would actually recommend to everyone to read is Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Near.
Okay.
That is a book that is pure prediction. Ray is one of the people who says, I am predicting. By the way, here's my record for the past 20 years, which is very impressive.
Right.
And then he says, "This, you may be find this hard to believe, but this stuff all extrapolates out of data that's around today." So if people want to read a really radical description of the future, that's one that is quite phenomenal. And then I'm going to be mentioning things here that I've written, I've blogged on. And so if you go to my website, right next to my picture, it says Joel Barker's blog. If you click on that, you can get a URL for these things to read about them in depth if you want to.
Okay, and I would make the argument, just to make the point,
sure,
that, you know, just like theology really just means words about God, predictions just, I would imagine, just means pre-talk, right? Just means dictations about the before it happens.
Yeah.
So this is all it is. I mean, it's pre-talk, but it's your chance of being able to say, this is something that's happening before.
Right.
And so it may or may not happen, but it should be interesting pre-talk anyway.
It's,
so what do we have?
It's pre- the connotation, not the denotation. Ian.
There you go.
The problem.
Let me give you
a quote. We'll get started with a quote. Ken Bolding, it fits with what you said. The future will always surprise you, but you needn't be dumbfounded.
There you go.
That's what we're going to work on.
All right, here we go.
All right, little things. Waterless toilets by 2020. Throughout the south of the U.S. and in many other countries, toilets will no longer flush. And the reason for that is because water is becoming the choke point. You cannot make a city work without water. And when you use fresh drinking water to flush toilets, you're wasting a really precious resource. So at a minimum, the second and third toilets in a home will have to be waterless. And my guess is in many cities and states, everything will have to be waterless.
This will be chemical then? Or chemical then?
No, it's what's going to happen is it's going to be captured, picked up by waste management once a week, just like they pick up your garbage, and converted through composting into rich black soil so we actually use the stuff and we don't mix chemicals and ruin it. Biggest problem with our waste materials, put a whole bunch of water with it, and it costs too much to get it back to a dense form where it has its high nutrient value for soil. Mm-hmm. So I see this as actually becoming a very significant resource for re-enriching soil that has been damaged over the last 30 years.
All right, what else?
Second one, vertical farming within cities. And Scientific American, by the way, has a really extraordinary article on this. I think it was 2 months ago, where they very seriously propose that we need to bring our food growing process into the cities and put it in a vertical building, literally floor by floor, be growing things. Again, efficiencies, water efficiencies, pesticide efficiencies, but also locality efficiencies. Instead of shipping something from California to New York, you're shipping it from the Bronx to Manhattan.
Now, you know, that makes a lot of sense in terms of the square footage in abandoned buildings, warehouses, former industrial complexes that they can't sell, they can't move. Why not compete, whether that's hydroponic or whatever the, however they would do it, that makes a ton of sense for these big giant districts that they can't release.
And you absolutely nailed the key point. People said, oh, but the city's so crowded. The researchers went out and found all those places that you just named and said, no, there's more than enough space to do this.
All right, cool. Interesting idea.
Yep.
And that brings me back to something you also talked about, the algae farming, the vertical algae farming was going to provide a new fuel source.
Yep.
Is that on your list?
Yep.
Is that on your list?
Yep. Well, I mentioned it in a larger sense of just new fuels.
Okay.
Yeah. But Vertigro, the whole concept is that, well, think about this. China has 100 cities of 1 million people or more. Rural people are coming in every day. What are they good at doing? Growing things.
Right.
Where can they go to work? In the vertical farm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're using their skills.
Boy, I like that a lot.
In an urban setting. I do too. Like I say, Scientific American does a very nice job in the description.
You know, and you and I would, this is something that we would relate to here, being here in the upper Midwest. You see a lot more of these giant silos, these grain silos by railroad tracks. They're already, many of them are already abandoned, huge spaces, and already by railroad tracks.
Yeah.
So
keep in mind, once you get this thing going, there's not much railroading.
Well, I understand that you would use it locally too, but if you got to a place where you could either, because you had to ship in soil or you had to do it, you could do it all by rail as opposed to having to do a lot of trucking. And that's kind of a cool idea.
And think about this, with your waterless toilets and all that wonderfully composted soil in the cities.
You had to ruin it. You had to ruin it.
Well,
you're doing so well. And then you had to throw in compost that comes from everybody's waterless toilets.
That's right. But keep in mind that this is systems thinking. And that is the 21st century requirement. If you can't think of systems, you don't see the opportunities.
All right. Well,
okay, more systems.
I'll get on board with that later.
Right. I think we talked about biochar and terra preta, didn't we?
Yeah, the terra preta. Yep. Remember this? This is the new soil thing?
You better believe it. In a company in Denver now has built a machine that will basically automates the process. And it produces its own fuel from the biomass as it does it. So all you do is you bring it into the village, you set it down, and it starts producing it as you feed it, as you feed the waste plant material into it. And when you think about, again, another, what, a billion and a half mouths to feed by 2020, we have got to enrich the soil around the world. And this is a system which also captures huge amounts of carbon. And I should just tell everybody, I do believe in global warming. It is not a hoax, as everything I've read. If it is, I'll be happy because it means then we were not threatened. But I think we've got to be serious about our activities and do things that will do that.
I think that there's a difference too, and some people, and I stand on the fence on some of this, the difference between there being global warming in terms of it being a natural biological trend or whether this is something that's exacerbated by our own technologies. I sometimes have a hard time seeing how that science works, but I do think that we're obviously experiencing warming in some respects, but it could just be a natural cycle. But either way, we got to be prepared for it. So, all right, what else?
Exactly. Okay. Energy sources. Shale gas has been the big discovery back domestically here. It looks like we have 72 years minimum of natural gas to provide all the energy we need if we substitute it for coal, which allows us to cut the carbon content by 50% coming out for energy, and it's all the dollars circulate inside the United States. That's big deal number one. Number two, we know about wind and wave energy, but there's a third thing that I think is going to be important, and that is I think we're going to come back to nuclear. The one I'm most interested in is called the Traveling Wave Nuclear Fission Reactor, and I've got it in my blog, so you can really follow it up, so I won't go into detail.
Okay.
But what's cool about it is it takes U-238, which right now is considered a waste material, turns it into a fissile material, and then burns it down so you can safely get, you know, safely within quotes. But you don't have plutonium when you're done. You don't have stuff that lasts 250,000 years. But when you take that combination of wind, wave, nukes, and shale gas, we can move very quickly to a sustainable future that has minimum impact on the environment.
Yes. And that brings us back to then electrical cars, isn't it? How we can more easily have...
Absolutely. Because once you have a good electrical source, now you can do electric cars. The big things, MIT quick charge lithium battery, but I literally yesterday was reading about a new discovery at Stanford. It's a paper battery using standard office paper, 8.5 by 11, with nanotech powder on it, and it produces a really good battery that outperforms most other batteries, extremely inexpensive, easy to make, could be commercialized within 3 years.
Paper battery?
Here's what's interesting. It's nanoscale material, nanoscale silver fibers,
okay,
nanoscale carbon, properly and basically ink jetted onto the surface of the paper, and then you stack the paper.
So you stack the paper like you would, say, outside of a copy machine, but you put it inside of a plastic case and you run current through it.
You got a battery. It charges up, and off you go. And what they say is the guy from Rensselaer Polytechnic said that the performance is excellent. And this is just the first round on this thing.
I'm holding you to this one. I'm calling you back. If you get this one wrong, I'm calling you back.
The thing that's important is, excuse me.
Not a problem.
We're starting to really hone in on the quality of battery technology that allows us to have a car that we can drive 300-400 miles and recharge in minutes.
Okay.
Once you have that, all of these other, you know, let's do fuel cells, let's do diesel, it all goes away because electric is the easiest thing to do.
And if you're getting your electric from these low-cost, low-carbon-emitting sources, kajang, we win.
And
we win with a new technology. We went into the new technology that not only lowers our overhead business costs, but also, you know, changes our dependence on foreign governments and for foreign businesses, and we're able to pay things back, and that'd be cool.
And all this stuff I'm telling you about, by the way, is U.S. patents.
Yeah,
universities own it, so it
USA.
Is. We have the patents,
USA.
and we can build it.
Cool. And then, so what about city cars here? Then?
City cars, basically, this is the idea that you and I don't really own a car. There are cars all around. We call up and say, I need a car today. They say, walk one block from your house. There'll be a car there. You take a special card, slice it in. Of course, this is going to be electric with those batteries. Drive to where you're going, do what you want to do. You park it when you want, walk back in the house or maybe a close parking place. We're already doing that with gasoline cars. Now when we move into the next stage, what it does is it changes the total number of vehicles that you have to have in a city for everybody to get around on an individualized basis.
Yeah, okay, but doesn't that seem like that's kind of pointless if everything's electric and running on these paper batteries? Then it's like, well, everybody, once you convert to that, then what's the number of cars you have is immaterial.
Yes and no, because you use the term, it actually is material, because if you have, think about having a whole bunch of material that's only used 2% of the time.
Right.
As opposed to a whole bunch of material that's used 90% of the time, in terms of the value trade-off of the amount of material you put in for what you're getting a much bigger value for the dollar.
Okay, but that's true up until when you're able to make cars out of the broccoli that children won't eat.
Actually,
right? I mean,
I'm going to get to that in a minute.
Okay. That's on the list.
It is on the list. That's right. Okay. We'll talk about nanopaper here in a minute.
Okay. All right. What else you got?
A couple other things is probably we're going to see our jet planes fueled by hydrogen because it's the cleanest fuel that we can burn, least impact, and still give us the result that we want. So we'll see that, and that's a good thing. We're going to see U.S. education finally get rid of the summer thing because we have to compete with the rest of the world, and they do not give their kids 90 days off in the summer. They typically go to school 225 to 250 days.
But how will I bring in my wheat crop?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, I don't have my chillens here to help me with my crop.
Actually, Ian, it won't be a problem because they'll go down to the high-rise building and help do it.
There you go. I love that idea, by the way. I think that vertical farming thing is totally
cool.
It's
a hot thing, I think. Okay, now, this is the new digital reality. I want to read a quote from Jan M. Kruth, who's a Association of Professional Futurists. He sent me this note. He said, make sure you say this. And I said, this is great. The new digital reality is replacing our thousands of years old physical reality as the primary source of information that shapes our minds, our actions, and our lives. Two quick stories. Nordic Track has a Google-based treadmill. You clip, you say, I want to walk this pathway in these mountains. Google finds the mountains, finds the pathway, and as you are walking on the screen, the walking surface moves up and down, changes angles to match the actual angle of the walk.
Cool.
That's a digital reality.
Like that.
Second digital reality, I was with my granddaughter, Sophie, at the state fair. One of her friends walks by. Sophie opens up her phone and texts her a message saying, I think you just walked by me here at the state fair.
Okay. That's Why don't you just go, hey, Sally?
No, because she's in the digital reality.
I know, but that's just lame for me. Use your vocal. I'm afraid that the future is we'll lose our vocal cords to evolution because we'll be using nomadic and texting each other instead of just calling.
Well, the digital reality does start changing things. And so we talk about e-textbooks and stuff like that.
E-textbooks like Kindle for kids, you mean?
Yeah, the entire curriculum of books will be on one 8.5 by 11 full color plus all the other stuff, but we're done with the paper books, and the kids will never have an outdated textbook again. Plus, we can give them a whole bunch of primary references that we never could have afforded to do otherwise.
We could send them off to kindergarten.
Very good.
I want to make a point about that e-textbook idea. I think there's, as we see today, because of the printing costs of textbooks, we know that some states, Texas is being one of them, and this whole creationist debate and all of the other stuff, that they changed the scope of textbooks for all the rest of the country.
Exactly.
If these powerful school districts say, well, we're not going to accept your book unless it has this in it. This would allow people to cater their textbooks to their region and make them, you know, more or less scientific or more or less relevant to the community.
Yeah, and that's a really important thought, that actually all the rest of the states regain their control over their own textbooks.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. All right, electronic gaming industry.
Yep.
Well, this is not a hard sell. This seems like there's like unlimited future for gaming.
It's huge. And what you have to think about is not only does it dominate entertainment, it's going to dominate education because of the digital reality.
Right.
Kids will put on goggles, they'll be in three dimensions. All of a sudden, they can go to Venus and walk the surface. They can go to Mars and walk the surface. They can take a flight at the speed of light around the solar system. They can, you know, all these things become possible.
I like the historical aspect of it, too. Oh. My kids can understand the invasion at Normandy so much better with Call of Duty.
Right.
And although it gets sensationalized a little bit, and I'd like to think that for educational purposes, they might scale back the dimension perhaps of the gaming aspect of that. That to put people in a case where you are getting off of, you know, you're jumping off of one of these transports onto a beach and you're looking up at the, you know, you really get a sense of the enormity of D-Day much better with that. All right, when we return here in just a moment with Joe Barker, we'll start getting your calls. People are already going crazy on the phones for you. But let's get to more of your predictions too. The foam medals and the Bucky paper. We mentioned Bucky paper before. I want to get back to Bucky paper. I want my Bucky paper. More too with Joel Barker's predictions about the year 2020 and your comments and questions next too on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.